Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International Law and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, February 27, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear our second episode of the Security Partnership Series, this one about public-private partnerships in cybersecurity and technology. My name is Laura Flint. I am the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Catherine B. Lotriante, Director of the Institute for Law, Science, and Global Security, and Visiting Assistant Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Also, Adam Siegel, Ira A. Lippman Chair of Emerging Technologies and National Security and Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Finally, we are happy to have Adam Perlman, our moderator and special advisor to the International and National Security Law Practice Group. I will turn it over to Adam Perlman to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Adam. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Lauren. And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our second part of this three-part teleforum series on security partnerships. In our first installment, Governor Tom Ridge, our first secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, discussed federal, state, and local partnerships and counterterrorism efforts. As Laura mentioned, today's call is on public-private partnerships and cybersecurity. I will begin this call in my normal fashion, and that is to note that any views I might express today are mine alone and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position of the Department of Defense or any agency of the United States government. Today, we're pleased to have with us two highly respected scholars in the field of cyber, cybersecurity, and cyber other stuff, for lack of a more professional term. As Laura mentioned, Adam Siegel holds multiple positions in the Council on Foreign Relations and is formerly CFR's Maurice R. Greenberg Senior Fellow in China Studies there and an Olin Fellow in Asian Studies. He also speaks Mandarin Chinese. Among other honors that he has earned, he was a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in Technology and Security. He has bachelor's, master's, and his doctorate degrees from Cornell, as well as a master's from Tufts, and is the author of The Hacked World Order, How Nations Fight, Trade, Maneuver, and Manipulate in the Digital Age, published last year. Dr. Lotriante holds many positions at Georgetown, including being the director of its cyber project and executive director for its Institute for Law, Science, and Global Security. Before that, she spent 4 years on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, a brief time as counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, 6 years at the Central Intelligence Agency's Office of the General Counsel, and began her legal career with the Department of Justice. Her PhD is from Georgetown, as well as a master's. She has a JD from NYU and her bachelor's from UMass Amherst. Now, as behavior in the cyber domain has become perhaps the most ubiquitous asymmetric threat to modern life, governments, companies, and individuals each have unprecedented exposure to theft and sabotage. Home networks are compromised through connected thermostats. Commercial airliners' flight controls have been hacked through in-flight entertainment systems. Password and credit card data are stored on servers that are the targets of daily hacking attempts, with that data often appearing for sale online. Now, this teleforum will examine the complex mechanics and ethics of cyber partnerships. Hacks on vital commercial and financial systems make the news constantly. Target, Home Depot, Yahoo, JPMorgan Chase, Adobe, LinkedIn, iCloud, Sony, passwords, credit card information, and personal and corporate communications all are at constant risk. Government systems are likewise frequently targeted. Last year, the Government Accountability Office released a report noting a single U.S. government agency was hit by more than 1,300 cyber attacks in 2014 alone, and that number is only increasing. Certain statutes require disclosure of cyber vulnerabilities in certain circumstances. For For example, the National Defense Authorization Act for 2013 and 2015 required defense contractors to report penetrations of networks and information systems and allow DoD personnel to access equipment and information to assess the impact of the attack. Now, our experts today will discuss what we can actually expect in terms of cybersecurity and what information needs to be shared, among whom and when, to maintain as robust a cyberspace posture as possible. Now, Adam and Catherine, going back to what feels like the dark ages of the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative, and then we have a framework set up by NIST. There are now proposed amendments to that framework, and recently a allegedly leaked draft of an executive order on cybersecurity. Looking at this progression of policy documents and with legal heft, are we improving our cyber posture relative to advances in the threat environment?
I think it's a great point, right? If you look back over the last 8 years, we've actually had a tremendous amount of movement on the policy side. So not only the NIST framework and the other things you mentioned, but, you know, White House international strategy, two DoD strategies, three or four executive orders on information sharing, sanctions, cyber threat coordination, incident coordination. But I don't think anyone believes that we are getting ahead of the problem. I think given the last year and a half set of attacks, we seem to be, if not falling behind, then certainly treading in place. You know, there are many reasons for that. I think, you know, clearly the top three probably are, you know, we're creating increasingly complex systems. So no matter how much we eventually figure out how to defend, we still are increasing our complexity through the Internet of Things and other types of systems. Second, even though we had this progress on the policy side, clearly the government moves more slowly than the private sector, and certainly more slowly than the pace of technological change. So not only have we had kind of slow growth on the legislative side, but, you know, we still are dealing with IT procurement and other policies that can't respond and are not agile enough. And then third, I think we've suffered from a failure of imagination, and that is, you know, our adversaries have a wealth of targets to go after, and while we've kind of conceived of the risk for a long time as a cyber Pearl Harbor, a digital 9/11, a critical attack on critical infrastructure that causes destruction and disruption, what our adversaries have been most willing to do is espionage and then disruptive attacks on private sector, the Sony, the DNC, and others that create political outcomes but are not the types of attacks we had imagined before.
I can concur with Adam on his take in terms of being behind the curve with respect to keeping up with the threat environment, which, you know, historically outside of the cyber domain, it's not surprising. As the technology becomes more complex, the adversaries become more imaginative or innovative in terms of how they can get around the defensive postures of both governments and the private sector. So it's typically, as with the law itself, in defining and coming up with solutions to threats, you're going to be chasing the threat actors. And as you evolve in terms of your, for instance, in the cybersecurity tools that you use to defend yourself, the adversaries are just as busy, if not busier, finding creative new ways to get around those defenses. And I mean, the progress, as Adam pointed out, we do have a lot of data points where we can point to in the last anywhere from 5 to even if you go back 15 years, where the U.S. as a government has improved because it is working towards and developing different strategies and policy, trying to look at the laws and how we can change our own domestic law and quite a lot of efforts at the international level that's happened over the the recent number of years, which all indicates progress. But these things do take a long time, particularly when you're negotiating between states in terms of how states are going to behave through a process like the UN process with diplomats. Each state, obviously thinking from their own sovereign interests, are not going to be readily and quickly wanting to limit what they can do in this space. So it does take time, but we can point to progress, even the fact that we have, you know, international strategies and we have information sharing legislation that was supposed to, under the Obama administration, you know, break down some of the resistance from the private sector sharing with the government, as well as the government sharing with the private. That's an element that will still take time to actually improve. But at least the problems seem to have been identified, that one, we need international cooperation at the state level to deal both with the cybercrime and also by the state actions itself, malicious actions. But we also need and have a recognition that the private sector plays a critical role in the defense, not just of themselves, but of our critical infrastructure in the country, and that not the government alone can't solve this problem and defend, and the private sector alone can't, but there must be a joint effort. And that's where, for the last number of years, there's been emphasis and focus on the best mechanisms for information sharing between both the government and the private sector in order to be able to try to confront the threats. And you do have, there are some hopeful other points of progress in terms of the breach reporting that comes out each year. You do see in some of the reports, like the Verizon data breach reporting, that the time it's been taking companies to even recognize that their perimeter security and their networks have been hacked, that time is decreasing, which is a positive sign, although when it still takes days or weeks to get there, that's not a satisfactory point. But you do see progress and work being done by also DARPA and other entities in terms of innovative ways to get at the problem through artificial intelligence. So there's indications of progress, and yet I don't think anyone thinks we're ahead of the curve and kind of going to be able to maintain that. We're still, I think, trying to catch up and trying to be one step ahead of the adversaries, which is a challenge.
I think that's certainly not unique to the cyber field. I think there's a lot of aspects of law and security that always seems to be playing catch up. But in this respect, I mean, who should be enlisting whom for help? Should the government be calling on private security firms to help prevent hacking of their own systems? And at what point do private companies turn around and say, hey, government, can you help us out securing ours?
So I think, I think it goes both ways. I think it's important to have both involved in part of the solution. And it depends on the problem that you're trying to solve at the time, but there is already existing relationships between the government, particularly when it comes to FBI and their investigations of some of the cyber intrusions. They have brought on a number of the cybersecurity companies, particularly to help with the analysis, forensics, or part of the attribution. So private companies can play a role in supporting the government, particularly their criminal investigations that FBI has been conducting. And I also think that the private sector, as they've requested from the government, some entities have been more frustrated in terms of when they ask for help from the U.S. government, it is often not as quick as they would like it, or the information is not as useful as they would need it to be in order for them to defend their private networks. So I think there's always room for improvement. That it comes down to, though, of course, priorities for the U.S. government after identifying which agency should be the front or the cooperating agency with the private sector in this country. You know, the Americans have determined that it should be a civilian agency. And on, you know, criminal investigations, it's FBI. And you got to make sure that FBI has the resources in order for them to, you know, answer all the calls that come in from the private sector once they've kind of had an intrusion. So it's that has to be worked on, but certainly both can actually help each other. But the information the private sector has found to be most critical and sometimes difficult for the U.S. government to share, the private companies have requested and would like as much current information about the threat actors themselves so they can actually prepare, you know, before an intrusion. So the short answer to that is I think there's a mechanism and there are legal frameworks to allow both the private sector to help the government, as they've been doing already, and particularly the criminal investigations, but also the government to assist the private companies. Now, of course, we have domestic legal frameworks in which our government has to operate within, and each agency has its own authorities, but also limitations vis-a-vis the private sector in terms of the extent that the government can actually be involved in the private sector networks and in data that is private data. Of course, there'll be some limitations in there.
Right. I think from the beginning, there's been a kind of broad philosophical agreement on U.S. cyber strategy that, you know, one of the defining characteristics of cyberspace is that it rests in the hand of the private sector. And so no successful strategy would ever be created without having the private sector take the lead on many of the fronts. That I think has been kind of broadly agreed on from Clinton onward. And then the question is then in the specifics, and in particular, what role does the government have in defending the private sector, especially if the private sector has to defend itself against a nation state attacker? You know, here the risk is, you know, overregulation or too much intervention that affects innovation. But on the other hand, and you don't want to create a moral hazard where companies believe that the government is going to come to their defense and protect them. But there's no way that any private company can keep, you know, the Dukes or Putter Panda, whatever you want to call the APT groups, out, and where are they going to step in? We've seen Defense Department officials say that, you know, there's only between 1 or 2% of attacks that they think the military will get involved in. But that question has not been resolved and is constantly kind of a source of tension. I think, as you know, Catherine said, it depends on what the problem is you're trying to solve, right? There are, you know, I think in the CSIS and in the National Cyber Commission reports that came out, you know, suggestions that a lot of day-to-day cybersecurity will be handled by private companies because the government agencies will move to the clouds. And so that those are, you know, defense is going to be taken over by Amazon and Google and others who have, you know, resources and can attract higher level cybersecurity expertise than the public sector can right now. We also have this very interesting space now where so much of the attribution is being done by private sector actors, right? It was CrowdStrike and FireEye and others who came out first and attributed attacks to Chinese state and Russian state hackers. So we're in this very interesting space where it just depends what the question is, where that line is going to be drawn between public and private.
Yeah, I actually find that the attribution issue is quite fascinating from a legal perspective, in terms of particularly international relations between states, and if there's a legal case in front of the International Court of Justice, because if the private sector remains the lead or quite capable in the attribution, and the government doesn't do as much of it publicly for various reasons, it is interesting because the question from a kind of a legal criminal approach is, ultimately in a case or prosecuting someone, the attribution is critical for the culpability. So for the government to actually carry out the law enforcement actions, they're going to have to be capable. And in some of the domestic cases, you can rely on the work of private entities. What's interesting at the international level, for instance, if we're talking about things, state actions at the use of force level or even below, the courts at the international level have been less willing to accept as evidence, private sector evidence based on technical or non-technical attribution. It's what they want is the government's. And so it is interesting to see how the private sector has been in the lead, calling individuals or entities or governments out for some of the hacks. And it's unusual, and typically in other threats and other environments outside of cyber, it is the government that you see typically making these calls. But ultimately, the government will have to use this information depending on what the issue is or what the problem is, whether it's criminal cases or WTO dispute settlement cases, or even at the ICJ or at the Security Council. It may involve the use of private sector attribution reports.
So, say private sector company gets hacked, you hire somebody to attribute the attack, and you've got a pretty high confidence level that you found the bad actor. What are your lawful responses? Is it simply legal action? Is it name and shame? Or are we beyond that?
Again, I mean, I think it depends what type of hacking or type of actor you're involved in. I mean, clearly, if it's a domestic attack, then you can pursue legal measures on it. If it is Chinese or Russian state hackers, then you know there's little you can do unless the U.S. government is going to get involved, right? If the U.S. government decides that this is a case where they're going to try to make an example of the hackers, either, you know, for example, with the Iranian DDoS of the U.S. financial institutions or with Chinese cyber espionage, then perhaps there might be an indictment or sanctions followed there. The next step many have suggested is hacking back or active defense. I don't think that's a good idea. I am primarily, especially in the Chinese case, worried about signaling and misperception, especially in a crisis with the Chinese. I can imagine that, you know, there's some incident with the Chinese Navy in the South China Sea, and the two sides are standing off, and someone is hacking back because Chinese hackers took their intellectual property that quickly spills out of control and leads to kinetic effects. So I don't think that the next step is the private sector going after the data themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think what we've seen in the discussion in the U.S. around the active defense has been going on for a number of years. And what you've seen is the U.S. government itself is very hesitant to necessarily open up the door, whether it's through amending the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or in other ways giving authority to the private sector and I on its own to respond to these intrusions, particularly the international ones. And I think that's the right stance in terms of the potential for errors in conducting a response into a foreign territory, even with all good intentions, what could potentially end up in terms of either an error in the attribution or even if you've got the right person, something that's destructive inside another country's territory. You may very well end up with some very problematic and tense diplomatic relations or harmful effects to the U.S. relations with a state. And legally, there are also legal consequences based upon, the state responsibility. It may have been a private company from the U.S. and not the U.S. government conducting the act, but from the perspective of the state that has just been, if you will, hacked back, they will likely claim that it was the U.S. government, and that can lead to some unsettling consequences for the U.S. government. So I think there are some cautious, and rightly so, cautious approaches to what the private sector can legally do in response to the foreign threat actors. And as Adam said, if it's domestic, well, we have the domestic legal framework in which private companies can resort to. You know, oftentimes what I have heard from a number of the companies is that not every company can afford, as Microsoft being an example, kind of their efforts in a large scale in terms of working with DOJ and FBI to take down some of the botnets and the other threats. You know, not every company, U.S. company, can actually afford to do that. So there is a challenge in how that can be carried out within the legal framework, and it's time-consuming. But the other option of kind of letting private companies loose globally, the downside can be quite bad.
Right. So we're very unsophisticated analogy, I suppose, would be a non-proliferation regime for offensive cyber capabilities in the private sector or for private actors. So at what point, if government involvement is necessary or appropriate, who makes that determination? Should private companies, particularly financial institutions or infrastructure companies, be required to report hacking incidents to the federal government? If so, what kind of hacking incidents, and really for what purpose? Are we looking at consumer protection or economic security, or just the integrity of that individual company's systems?
So I think on this one, we have certain industries that are regulated. So we have a process in place for those private sector entities that are part of a regulated industry like the banks. They have requirements to their regulating authorities. So, you know, the SEC a couple of years ago came out with a rule that says that, you know, those companies that are publicly traded, that they need to report to the SEC, significant breaches. While there's some dispute at times on individual cases as to what rises to that level that needs to be reported, that still has to work its way through, and I think the court decisions ultimately may weigh in on that. So I think in the regulated industries, like the nuclear power plants and the banks, they have appropriate regulators which can call upon them and demand reporting. Now, how effective those regulators will be, it's up to them. They certainly have the authority to require certain reporting and also to kind of sanction those companies that don't comply with that. And there's mixed reviews on how aggressive the regulators will be, but they certainly have they don't need any additional legal authority than what they have. There are companies, though, that will fall outside of kind of regulated industries. But another group of companies, of course, where the government has more of a kind of a legal hold on the companies to require reporting would be, of course, those companies like the defense industrial-based companies that have contracts with the federal government. The government has required and can, through the contract relationship with those companies, that certain breaches are reported to the government, and then the government actually has an opportunity to investigate to actually find out for itself, you know, the extent of the breach. And that's because there's a contractual relationship. But other companies, it's a larger challenge. Companies that are not regulated or do not fall into, you know, a contractual relationship with the federal government, it is less clear as to what the government can immediately do in terms of requiring certain reporting. And I think the idea of sharing information was to have an environment or framework where this could happen, at least have some of the sharing before any breaches, but also after. And I think that was the intent of some of the NIST framework, was to allow the companies on a voluntary basis to start sharing and without the strong arm of the government forcing it. And I do believe that is kind of the approach that it's been debated for a number of years now on the Hill and in the public, that it seems that this is where this country, or at least the elected officials representing people and the private sector, feel that that's the best approach to take.
I mean, look, I think there are also some specific economic policies that breach laws and other transparency are supposed to accomplish, right? We can see that playing out in the Verizon Yahoo deal that it's supposed to give investors a better sense of the of what they're, you know, taking on and the other firms that they might be acquiring, I think there's also a kind of a large set of assumptions built into the more data we have on the breaches, then you start being able to create more efficient insurance and risk markets, which then, you know, incentivizes the private sector in the right way. I have often argued for that. I think there's increasingly some questions about if that will be true, given the way that, you know, cyber insurance may not act the way in that we think it will, or so far is not. But that seems to me also other reasons why you are trying to create these regulations for why the private sector and under what conditions it's going to be more transparent.
So, you know, all of this kind of begs the question of getting into the privacy issues. And when, you know, certainly sharing of information, certainly between private sector and with the government, gets into privacy of consumers or customers' records, and, you know, how deep you know, investigators can go and what they can do with that information. And, you know, there's likewise been a lot of discussion the last few years about the proper role of FISA court and court orders. Can you discuss briefly the differences in the regimes between, you know, court orders for active surveillance that the government wants to conduct versus, you know, what is involved with voluntary sharing on the cybersecurity side?
Well, I think you know, we're talking about a whole range of relations, and so as you said, you know, under FISA courts, court orders, the firms are going to, you know, in most cases hand over private user data in the course of an investigation or an intelligence investigation. I think that, you know, that has continued and that will continue. I think the issue with the information sharing for CISPA and other legislative, you know, there were privacy concerns that were involved. I think, you know, there are processes for minimizing that data for, you know, and making it more anonymous. I think most of those privacy sharing and privacy issues were kind of addressed in that. I think, though, there's a larger kind of disjuncture between, you know, policymakers, especially right now, and the technology community about, you know, privacy and cooperation, and that as the companies roll out more and more technological solutions to the problem, right, end-to-end encryption and other things that take compliance out of the company's hands, at least at the consumer level, then we, you know, then we get the standoff over the over the iPhone and the San Bernardino terrorists. Then we have a larger breakdown of trust. So that larger breakdown, I think, you know, is a kind of background factor, but then there's lots of cooperation that happens, you know, every day between, you know, the IC and the law enforcement agencies and the companies, depending upon what the specific topic is and what specific legal policy tools are being used. So I think, you know, broadly we see not great kind of relations, but on the other hand, people have to get business done and they go about it and they do it day to day.
Yeah, I agree. On the FISA court, so I see these as kind of different frameworks with maybe some of the same concerns, but less so on the FISA court side with respect to privacy. So you have, you know, court orders there where sometimes, you know, companies may be resistant, for instance, to some of the gag orders that were typically part of those court orders, that they weren't allowed to even say that they've been ordered to hand over certain documents. And the courts are, you know, working that out and, in fact, sometimes allowing the companies to actually be able to say that they received such an order. But there you're working on the privacy side of that. The court kind of has its authority in order to, and it's got to judge signing off on, and so you don't have the same kinds of privacy concerns as you do in terms of the voluntary sharing of the information between the private sector. But I think that's exactly what the debates around the legislation around CISPA was to solve, that there were a number of privacy concerns, and therefore how is the government going to ensure that private data was going to be protected as the companies were willing to share with the government. And I think that's what, on a day-to-day basis, gets worked out in an agreed format without a court, right, without kind of the legal ruling of judges. So I think it is, I think CISPA has at least seemed to satisfy most of those people from the privacy aspects, that this was an appropriate way to kind of handle the sharing framework.
Right, and we've focused a lot on the corporate level and government and company relationships. But I suppose my last question for you guys before we open it up to Q&A from the audience is, as for individual citizens who want to protect their data, I mean, how effective really are today's consumer level encryption algorithms, like what gave rise to the question over unlocking the iPhone after San Bernardino?
Well, if you're worried your opponent is a state-based attacker, then you're not going to be able to keep them out. An individual eventually is going to make a slip, even if they're using, the best encryption. At some point, you're just going to make a mistake, unless you're a trained in operational security or in intelligence. Then I just think, but for most people, commercially available encryption is going to be very useful for stopping criminals, and if not stopping state-based attackers, at least causing them some delays in getting your data eventually.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I'm kind of on the same wavelength that it, against a state actor, probably not going to make a difference. But if you're talking about the lower level criminals who are trying to get, your passwords and credit card information, it's useful.
All right. So everybody keep changing your passwords and don't respond to any emails from Nigerian princes. Laura, if you can open the floor up for questions, I want to thank Catherine and Adam for their time so far, and they've generously agreed to stay and answer a few questions.
Great. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. So let's go to our first question. Go ahead, caller.
Good afternoon. This is Mike Doherty. I am the CEO of LabMD, quite embroiled in a cybersecurity battle with the Federal Trade Commission, and also a long-term member of the Federal Society. My question goes to the lack of consistency within the government of what they're telling the business community and the tech community to do. I was on a panel, for example, in Miami about 6 months ago, where it was myself, someone from the Secret Service, someone from the FBI, and the audience was primarily financial professionals who said, let's see here, I'm supposed to feel free to speak to the FBI proactively to make sure that this doesn't happen and I'm armed well to react appropriately if it does. Yet if I admit this has happened, what am I supposed to do if the FTC or the FDIC comes after me for poor data security practices? One part of the government is causing my lawyers to tell me to not cooperate while you're telling me to show up. And so at that point, the poor guys from the Secret Service and the FBI said, don't have an answer for that. But I think it begs a bigger picture problem for the business community of the consistent inconsistency within a government. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'll take a shot at it. I would never, having worked in the government myself, I would never think that the different agencies or even the same agency is always consistent. So clearly there's going to be challenges. Each different agency will have its own mission and responsibility. One might be to help investigate a crime and to work with the private sector. And that agency, like the FBI, they're going to want as much data from a private company that'll help the FBI actually investigate and conclude investigation. But you're right, there are other agencies, their job is not to investigate and prosecute the criminals, but to actually regulate or have oversight over these private companies. And so there will be this tension. Both parts of the government are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, what I have heard from others and see what happening is that the voluntary standards that NIST put out seem to be the, in other words, the fallback playbook, that even though they're not mandatory, and as things are, either companies are being running into legal liability or in court, what I envision is that judges kind of looking, as they're trying to decide to assess liability and issues like that, they're going to have to look to some standard. And it seems to be that the NIST standard, the framework, is what's available. And so I think a lot of companies will be asked, if they find themselves in a situation where their regulators are challenging them, that they're, one of the first things they're going to be asked is, well, what have you been following and implementing the NIST standards? At least that's what I have started to hear. That, and more and more, I start to see the number of entities that are actually implementing the NIST standard, and I think for that very reason, that the lawyers are presumably thinking, okay, well, this is a standard, we can work with it at least, see how we implement it into our business, and then if we run into a problem, we can at least say that we're following these standards.
All right, just a reminder that to request the floor, you should enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll do a brief announcement before we go to the next question. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, February 28th. That call will feature three experts who will discuss the travel moratorium executive order. The call will feature Andrew C. McCarthy, senior fellow at the National Review Institute, David J. Beer, who's an immigration policy analyst at Cato Institute Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, and finally, Shireen Quadozi, Director of Muslim Matters at America Matters. Our lines are wide open for a question, so just a reminder to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Here we go, we have a caller. Caller, you can go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Michelle Roberts calling in. I'm in-house counsel at Deutsche Bank. And I wanted to ask the speakers to go back to the topic of AWS and Google. I thought I heard that the government is considering moving to the private cloud. So if you could confirm that. And then if you have any practice points or advice for practitioners who have to deal with vendors that are using AWS and Google and how you approach that.
I didn't mean to suggest that this was happening. I suggested this is two recommendations in some fairly prominent task forces, but I don't have any evidence that it's going to be accepted right now.
And is that because the security standards are actually higher?
I think there's a sense that the security capabilities are higher. Given that so many of the federal agencies have difficulties in attracting qualified cybersecurity expertise.
Just a reminder, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'm not seeing any questions right now.
Here, Adam, I'll ask, you had mentioned at the beginning of the call the increasing complexity of cyber systems, and you've mentioned now a couple times the difficulty of recruiting cyber talent. I suppose there's a positive correlation there. Do you expect that delta to get wider as time goes on?
You know, all projections show that the demand will continue to grow. And certainly, you know, in fact, you see more and more players into the space in the private sector, right? So, you know, all the auto companies now have cybersecurity expertise, and so they're going to have bigger wallets to open than the private sector. You know, the question is going to be is perhaps technologically we get ahead of the problem, right? There's a sense that that automation, machine learning, and big data may provide some kind of assistance there, right? And DARPA had the challenge. Of course, pessimists will tell you that then the attackers will just start using the same tools. So that, I think, is still uncertain.
Again, the floor is wide open, so to request it, please enter star, then the pound key. Not seeing any questions. Adam Perlman, do you have any more questions for our speakers?
I want to thank our speakers very, very much for their time today, and remind everybody that the third and final call in this security partnership Celeform series is going to be on March the 9th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That
Great.
Call, by the way, will feature Ambassador Ryan Crocker, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Bill Leitzau, and Sally Schwartz, who is a private practitioner in Paris, formerly the chair of the ABA Section of International Law.
Everyone should look forward to that call coming up shortly. Adam Siegel, and we have a question. So let me go to caller. You can go ahead.
Hi, Mike. Good afternoon. My name is Tony Murphy. I'm with the Department of the Navy. My question is about the emerging role of the insurance market in providing cyber insurance and the difficulty in the development of that market, which, of course, you know, insurance providers being one of the biggest private actors in terms of assessing risk in so many other areas. If you could comment on the difficulties in the emergence of that market and the difficulties in evaluating the risks and developing the metrics associated with those risks, et cetera. Thank you.
Yeah, I knew when I raised that I shouldn't do that because then somebody was going to ask me the follow-up question. but I can, I would suggest that we actually, the council did a study on cyber insurance written by my colleague, Rob Kanaki, that looked at some of the issues and how the federal government may step in to address those. You know, I think some of the issues have been that it has been hard for the companies to insurance companies to figure out, as you said, to price the risk and price the cost to companies, and that the people that are in charge of buying the insurance are often the wrong people, right? It's not the CIO or the CISO, so they don't have a sense of what they're trying to cover, what they're trying to prevent. Underwriting isn't working the way that it's supposed to work. The structure of the insurance often is transferring the risk to the wrong people, and the claim process is often too expensive. It's uncertain and too infrequent. I think those are some of the issues that have kind of hurt the development of the market, which is still very small compared to, you know, insurance in the fiscal space.
And that sounds like it requires a lot of private-to-private information sharing.
To request the floor, please enter star, then the pound key.
All right.
Yep, not seeing any more questions. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.